Any team that's tested AI tools for data has seen the pattern already. AI gives a different number than your BI tool. Metrics don't match across teams. And inevitably, users lose trust. It turns out, turning on AI is easy, but making it work on data is not. Hex AI was built to solve this. The key is nailing context. Hex is built to unify and curate your data context for agents. Data teams can observe, govern, and continuously improve every AI answer, so answers get smarter the more your team asks. The result? Your entire organization asks data questions in natural language and trusts the answers. Not because the AI got lucky, because it knows your business and its data. Because that's what an AI analytics platform should do. Join data teams from Cursor, Lovable, Ramp, AWS, and over 2,000 more at hex.ai.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
George V, never a dull moment. The lasting reputation of George V is for dullness. His biographer, Harold Nicholson, famously quipped he did nothing at all but kill animals and stick in stamps. The flamboyance and hedonism of his father, Edward VII, defined an era whose influence and magnetism are still felt today. The contrast between the two could not be greater. Was that really all there was to George V, the author of George V, Never a Dull Moment? Thinks not. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere from a rather chilly UK, I believe, is Jane Ridley. Jane, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles.
Good to have you with us. I said, how are you? And you said cold. Whereabouts are you, by the way, today?
I'm in London.
So George V, again, you could perhaps argue that he is unfairly a forgotten monarch. We know about his father, Edward VII, flamboyant, the Edwardian age, Victoria, of course, and then we get into, you know, the drama of the abdication and then the Second World War. George V, I think, has been unfairly overlooked.
George V reigned, you know, from 1910 to 1936, a long time, but he has been overlooked. Indeed, he has. He's been overshadowed by his father, and he has been seen as a king who, you know, really deserves to be overlooked as a sort of dull man. And I've tried to challenge this in my book.
One of the royal advisors, Thomas Lascelles, said that, well, he was dull, that's beyond dispute, but my God, his reign never had a dull moment. And perhaps that's what you want. If you look at what happened across Europe in that period between the end of the First World War and the 30s, there was huge upheaval. And perhaps you didn't want a flamboyant monarch, you wanted a steady pair of hands.
I think that's right. I mean, it was an incredibly turbulent time. You know, he came to the throne in the middle of the worst constitutional crisis that Britain had had for centuries. And then no sooner was that solved than along comes the First World War, you know, the biggest casualties of any war that Britain's been involved with. And then through the 1920s, it was also difficult. Threats of socialism, general strike, Bolshevism, etc. And you need what George had was a steady pair of hands. He emerges as a really effective political operator, really. And he is able to sort of not just keep the monarchy on board, but play a big part in keeping stability in Britain.
I mean, the thing is, now we're looking at this, you know, over 100 years have passed, but we tend perhaps not to realise how many monarchies were going to the wall across Europe. The rise of anarchism, the rise of Bolshevism, as you said before. You mean heads of state were being assassinated, basically, and you could describe them as maybe minor aristocracy heroes were being assassinated seemingly every month in Central Europe.
Absolutely. In the Balkans, monarchs were being assassinated, also in Portugal. And then, of course, the First World War was really bad news for monarchies and empires. And the three big emperors of Europe, you know, the Emperor of Austria, the German Emperor, and the Russian Emperor, they all are forced to leave. So it's and you know, this contrast with the British monarchy is really interesting, because in Britain, George actually becomes stronger and more popular after the First World War than he'd been before it. So there's a big contrast there.
And of course, the First World War throws up a myriad of problems for them. First of all, not, you know, the Saxe-Coburg situation.
Yes. Well, monarchs, on the whole, aren't really aware what, you know, they don't think a lot of their surname. But and George was slightly shocked to remember that his surname was Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, which was the name that his grandfather, Prince Albert, had brought to Britain. Somebody quipped that he was an alien. And this made him feel very uncomfortable indeed. And so in 1917, George really reinvents the British royal family by giving it the name of Windsor.
Not only that, but, you know, because you only have to look at sort of various pictures of the royals to realise how related, and that's a stupid word to use, but there you go, how related they were, you know, across Europe. And you look at the Tsar, you know, Nicholas II, and you realise the close ties that the Saxe-Coburg-Gothas and the Russian royal family had. And he takes the move of basically not allowing family to flee to Britain from what will ultimately be the people who kill him.
That's quite true. The links between George V and Nicholas II of Russia were really close. They were first cousins, and they were very good friends. Whenever George saw Nicky, he would write in his diary, you know, Nicky, dear Nicky, charming as usual. I mean, they were close, and they looked absolutely identical. And if they stood together, it was impossible to tell which was the Tsar and which was the King of England. And so that makes it even more sort of, I think, surprising that, you know, when revolution breaks out in Russia in February 1917, and Nicky is forced to abdicate, the Russian Provisional Government, the new revolutionary government in Russia, appeals to Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of Britain, and says, look, will you please give asylum to the Tsar? We don't want to kill him, but he's a danger here. And Lloyd George, who really wanted to keep Russia in the war, said, absolutely, yes, I will, but I must just consult the king. And at first, the king was quite, seemed to be fairly keen on this. But quite soon, it emerges that he's getting more and more cold feet over the whole prospect. And eventually, his secretary, Lord Stamfordham, goes down to Downing Street and said, look, this absolutely isn't on. The king is not prepared to accept this. There's a real fear that if the Tsar comes to Britain, that this will lead to kind of, you know, it will lead to the spread of the virus of Bolshevism amongst the British, and it will be bad for the king. So what you have here is that George being sort of ruthless as a monarch to save his own throne over his sort of family connections.
And again, it goes back to that threat that we said before. Monarchies were being toppled, people were being assassinated, and you know, dear Nicky ended up being shot by firing squad. There were also social upheavals during his reign with the suffragette movement. You know, it was George's horse that a suffragette threw herself under.
That was a terrible incident at the Derby when Emily Davison threw herself, you know, she went to the races with a normal ticket and she actually had a return ticket. It seems as though she thought she'd go back home after the Derby. But she, when the horses came pounding round the corner, she threw herself at the king's horse. And by some extraordinary fluke, I mean, no athlete could actually, you know, make sure that they fell in front of the horse that they were aiming for at 35 miles an hour. By some extraordinary fluke, she was killed. She was knocked over by the king's horse. The horse fell, the jockey fell, and she died a few days later. And in fact, Throughout the years before 1914, George and Queen Mary were sort of, you know, they were sort of constantly being attacked wherever they went by militant suffragettes. Certainly the suffragette movement was a big factor before 1914.
And then there is the, you know, the first Labour government. And, you know, to a monarch, this was a new thing. Again, looking at the background of Bolshevism, I mean, and, you know, the people wanting republics, did this not give, you know, to coin a phrase, George, it could have given him a really bad case of the collie wobbles?
Well, it certainly could. And at first he was really terrified by the idea of a Labour government for all the reasons that you suggest. But then, when in 1924, George makes the decision, basically that the Labour government, although it would be a minority government, is something that he will support. And he did all that he could to enable a Labour government. And one of the key things here was how they dressed. George was he was a martinet when it came to, you know, wearing the correct clothes, so the correct waistcoat with the correct coat, with the correct hat, all of that. And so his own court was ruled with a rod of iron, and they all had to wear these very old-fashioned coats called frock coats. But when it came to the Labour Party in government, he was so anxious to ensure that they would be able to, you know, function normally and turn up at court and do all the things that politicians were supposed to do in their relationship with the monarchy, that he said it was absolutely fine. They could wear whatever they liked. But, I mean, there's something deeper here, I think. George wrote in his diary in 1924, he said, "Today I appointed the first Labour government. I wonder what Grandma," that's Queen Victoria, "what Grandmama would have thought of it." And he realised just what he was doing, because by including Labour, giving Labour a place, you know, a political position within the political system, he was ensuring that it did not, he wanted to stop it becoming more extreme and becoming communist and republican. So it was a very clever move, and he did it very well.
Looking at social impact, you know, he's king during the First World War, and previous to that, you can argue that wars were fought far away. They were fought on mainland Europe. They were fought in the corners of the empire. The First World War, and they were normally fought by small armies, you know, expeditionary forces, that sort of thing. When it comes to the First World War, we have a conscript army. We have whole streets, whole neighborhoods being decimated of their young men, and the mental scars, and if you like, the community, you'd now call it post-traumatic stress disease that they go through. And there was that great, you know, we now think of the First World War of, you know, brave young men dying, being slaughtered whilst generals sit the back quaffing champagne. Was George aware of the horror that was going on, and also the impact it would have on communities when they returned from Flanders?
He was certainly aware of the horrors that were going on. He quite rightly made no attempt to actually direct the war. But he did go out to France to visit the troops 5 times. He was thrown off his horse and broke his pelvis quite badly. Where he played most of his role was in Britain itself. And of course, there was no fighting in Britain. But what there was huge numbers of wounded, completely sort of ruined, broken bodies of men coming back to Britain, flooding in to these hospitals. People who'd lost their arms, their legs, blinded by mustard gas, whatever it might be. These constant hospital visits that he went on, that he just lists in his diary. I mean, there were so many of them. Every day was taken up by hospitals or inspecting troops who were being prepared to go out to France. So it's very much a kind of sort of hands-on connection with his people that he develops during the First World War. It's not about publicity. It's not about being seen to do this. It's just about doing it, going to the hospital, seeing the people and witnessing these awful war wounds that have been inflicted.
And when you talk about him going out to see people, going to hospitals and that sort of thing, getting involved, that is When we think of our modern monarchy, that is a role that they do. And you can almost say that, you know, he establishes that, you know, that playbook, as we would say today, of going into the community, of meeting with people in a lesser extent. Obviously, this is in a pre-media and a pre-TV and a pre-shudder social media age, because that is very much what, the House of Windsor, that is the strongest card that they still play.
That is their day job. Absolutely. And I think, yes, you're quite right. Because, I mean, if you look back to his father, Edward VII, or to Queen Victoria, they very rarely had that kind of direct contact with people. Edward VII would drive about in a very grand car, but he wouldn't get out of the car. He'd just wave to the crowds. whereas George V and his wife Queen Mary are absolutely putting it into the hospitals and trying to sort of make contact with people directly, and that is one of the key changes that happens during George's reign. It's basically there's the issue of the First World War. There's also the fact that Britain in 1918 becomes a democracy. Monarchy has to respond. It can't just continue as a sort of distant, grand sort of ceremonial thing. It has to become more in touch with the people. And this was something that George was very much aware of.
And what was George's... I know this is the last question I'm going to ask about this particular. I want to come on to the family and Mary in a second. But, yeah. You know, now we live in, quote unquote, an aware society, some would say a woke society. And one of the big things that we are now reassessing is Great Britain's role and its empire and what that meant. And I know, again, it's difficult to look back at something 100 and whatever years ago with 21st century spectacles on, but what was George's relationship with the empire like? Because this is before the Second World War when everything changes. But what was his attitude to empire? And did he, you know, could he see that this wasn't going to last forever? Or was he just dealing with day-to-day, the day-to-day facts of the fact that, you know, Great Britain had an empire at this point?
Well, he was very much very conscious of the empire, and very much, you know, his initial plan when he became king in 1910 was to identify himself with the empire. That's to say, to visit as frequently as he could, and to sort of expand and build on its importance. And he did, you know, he went on a sort of, he had himself crowned again in India after his coronation in Britain, and he loved India very much. He went there twice. He was the first British monarch to go to India, but I think you have to make the point that his view of the British Empire was essentially, if you like, an old-fashioned view. And he was diverted from it, really, by all the crises that sort of, you know, that forced themselves upon him at home, not just the constitutional crisis, but then the First World War and all the things that we've been talking about, basically meant that for him, it was a matter of survival rather than making constructive plans for the British Empire. So I think his views about the empire were the kind of conventional views that you'd expect for the time, but that he was unable to play much part in practice just because of all the crises and emergencies that were happening back in Europe.
One of the things as well, this book, George the Fourth, Never a Dull Moment, George the Fifth, excuse me, Never a Dull Moment, brings up is the Queen Mary, who up until this point has been seen, you know, she was a formidable figure your biography, you know, shows what a strong partnership they were.
Queen Mary, she's been very much underestimated, I think. She's been sort of caricatured and she's been sort of described as the kleptomaniac queen because she was such an avid collector of antiques and china and things. But what I was trying to show in the book was that her relationship with George, her marriage, was really central. key thing in George's reign. And this very, I mean, she was intelligent. She was much more educated than George, who had a very poor education, surprisingly, really. She was interested in politics, and she really understood the role of the royal consort. That I think was the role that she played to perfection. That role of the, you know, the spouse who knows everything is an absolute key sort of influence on what's going on and the decisions that are made by the monarch. But in public, is always seen, you know, walking two steps behind and always defers to the monarch. We heard a lot about that earlier this year in connection with Prince Philip, who was a brilliant consort. And Queen Mary, too, was a brilliant consort. And she was crucial to George's success.
George may have had, as I said, been a safe pair of hands, but, you know, his quarrels with his eldest son set up a chain of events that would shake up the monarchy, obviously, after his death.
There's a paradox here, isn't there? Because on the one hand, he is very good and very quick and clever about making the monarchy stronger, about gaining popularity, about rebranding the monarchy, all the things that we've talked about. But on the other hand, you know, the absolutely fundamental function of any monarch is to ensure the succession, the relationship with the eldest son. And as you rightly say, George's relationship with his son, David, later Edward VIII, later Duke of Windsor, was really never good. There was a sort of competition and jealousy between the two of them. Edward, as a young man, was incredibly popular. He was a sort of rock star. He went on all these hugely successful tours around the empire. And I think there's a bit of jealousy from George's point of view. And there's also the fact that he resented the way that Edward was so incredibly sort of trendy. I mean, he was fashionable. He tried to modernize things. He wouldn't wear the clothes he was supposed to wear. And George couldn't, you know, he couldn't come to terms with this. I think you have to blame George, I'm afraid, really, because he was the more powerful figure in this relationship, although David must have been intolerable at times.
Well, the book is called George V, Never a Dull Moment. I'm so glad that you've shone a light on this largely forgotten but hugely important figure. If people want to find more information about yourself or the book, is there a website? Do you do the social media thing?
I'm ashamed to say I don't. They have to buy the book.
And the book will be available as a virtual download from our virtual bookstore. Only begs the question, after George V, who's next in your sights? Who do we do next?
Well, Judge, I wish I knew the answer to that question. I hate not having a book, but I haven't got a new project. So if you have a brilliant idea, please let me know.
Well, I will do indeed. But congratulations on the book. It's called George V, Never a Dull Moment. Please go out and get it because it's a fascinating read. Jane Ridley, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
It's 10:01 a.m. on a Monday, all at once. Your sales leader needs to know which deals are at risk. Your PM wants feature adoption by cohort. And your CFO needs one last graph for the board. Now your data team has to say no to somebody. Hex changes that. Ask any data question in plain English and get an analyst-grade response, all backed by your actual business context as defined by your data team. Start saying yes to more data questions at hex.ai.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.